I've been down roads from Churchill to L.A. Met kings of speed and stars along the way. They got stories that the cameras never show. Yeah, the truth behind the fame is what we know. From the saddle to the silver screen glow, fast lanes and punch lines on a late night show. You think you've seen it all, but you don't know the half till the curtain lifts and we all have a laugh. It's not just who they are, it's how they came to be. A little horsepower, a little mystery. It's Hollywood and horsepower, baby. Take a ride where the legends laugh and the engines never hide. From the track to the spotlight, stories unwind. Yeah, the truth's a little wild and one of a kind. Hollywood and horsepower, where the real ones show. Every twist and turn is a tale you didn't know. So pour a drink, sit back, enjoy the show. Where the fast and famous let it all go.
Welcome to Hollywood and Horsepower, the story of the show about the story behind the story. Today we are joined by a very special guest, a good friend of mine, and probably one of the most interesting people I know, Michael Blowen. Michael has had an amazing career. I mean, in a lot of ways, I'm green with envy, the people he's been able to work with, meet over the years. From the cinema to the stables, it's been said more than once. Started out with the Boston Globe as the entertainment writer, and then went on to several other associations, and then best known today as the founder of Old Friends Farm, the largest thoroughbred retirement farm in the world. So without any ado, Michael, welcome to the show.
Mark, thanks for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
It's an honor to have you. We always have fun, and I love hearing the stories. I mean, going to dinner with you is probably one of my favorite things in the world. I love hearing
the stories. It's mine, too, because you always pay.
Yeah. You can't beat it.
One of my
and now, you know, our show, and I'd be amiss if I didn't say this, our mutual friend, our show is brought to you today by Tony's Steak and Seafood, Indianapolis, Cincinnati,
great.
Lexington, and Bowling Green. So we'll be having many more dinners tonight or throughout the years with Tony's.
Fabulous. Well, that's a great restaurant. It really is. I'm not saying it because they're your sponsor.
Fabulous place, and he's a nice guy. You can't help but like him. And the food
is really nice.
Tony has a saying that I really like. He says, there's always room at our table for one more. And you know, it's funny, but I can honestly tell you, as somebody, you know how much I travel, and you know how many restaurants I go to, Tony actually is one of those guys that truly means that. You call them up, and they will do everything they can to get you in. And there aren't a lot of places that will do that. And then once you're in, I don't think I've ever been any place that has a better steak. And I'm not saying that because they support us. I'm saying that in all my travels, he has the best steaks of any place I've ever been. Everything is like a step above.
They're really terrific, especially when somebody else is paying for it.
Can't beat it. The best price in town.
Yeah, exactly. So, for me, it is, not for you.
I know. Well, I wanted to kind of jump in and really, I mean, it's kind of funny. On this show, we usually talk about what people don't know about somebody. And as hard as it is to believe, I think we're getting to the point where what a lot of people don't know about you is your time in Hollywood. You know, you've become so well known in the thoroughbred world that I'm sure, like in Boston and a lot of places, you're very well known for the Globe. But I bet a lot of people, especially in thoroughbred racing, don't know how, you know, and this is me saying, this is not you, but how big you were in Hollywood. I mean, people don't understand. When you were the entertainment writer, this is pre-internet. This wasn't like you jump on a phone like we are now and do an interview. You would go and sit down with these people. And you'd spend sometimes weeks out in Hollywood working different stories and following different things.
Yeah, I used up a lot of good jobs, Mark. really good job, teaching school, working at the Globe, having old friends and the horses. The horses are like my movie stars now. And I was very fortunate to work at the Globe at the time that I did, because the paper was running full throttle. We weren't allowed to do interviews on the phone, actually, because you didn't really know who was on the other end. Could it be anybody? So if
sure.
it was important enough to interview the person, they'd send you on a plane. So no matter where you want to go, you know, you'd go there to do the interview. And so they had a lot of money. We got to travel. I got to travel a lot. And it was fun. It was really, really fun. And it was at the very end of the old Hollywood at the beginning of the new Hollywood. So you got a little of this and a little of that. And it was really, really a lot of fun.
Well, and you know, you touched on that. It was kind of almost like, to me, like the golden era, like the end of the golden era. It was in my mind. I mean, I know
it was the end.
There's an actual date for the golden era.
There are so many publicists now. They have so many people. They have so many people protecting them that it's very difficult. It used to be you could get invited to movie sets and just hang around and watch to make the movie. And instead of waiting till the movie came out, and then everybody from the cinematographer through the director and the producer and all the stars, they were doing was a sales job. They're just trying to sell the movie. And so that's all you were getting. But if you hung around the set, you could actually report by yourself what you observed. And there's not a movie that I was ever on that didn't have at least two or three fights in one day, you know, where people were going into it. And you might think now they never have fights. Everybody loves each other. They think it's all like a Hallmark movie, and it's clearly not.
No.
But anyway, it was a great time. And you know, I can tell you some of the stories from some of the old stars that people might be interested in.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the ones that come to mind, and we can get into them, but, you know, you told me about going to dinner at Sheldon Leonard's house.
No, that wasn't Sheldon Leonard. What it was it was at Julius J. Epstein's house, the fellow who wrote like 40-something movies for Warner Brothers with his twin brother, Philip. It was Philip G. and Julius J. Epstein. You know, they wrote Yankee Doodle Dandy. They wrote, you know, to they're most known for writing Casablanca with Howard Koch. And, and they just were remarkable. And there was a movie with Tom Conte where he played a voracious English teacher in a small college in Vermont who was after all of his students. It was obviously 40 years ahead of the Me Too movement, but nevertheless, that was the movie based on a Peter DeVries movie with Tom Conte. And when I saw the credits, I said, oh, Julius J. Epstein, that's interesting. It must be related to the guy that wrote Casablanca. And I found out it was the same guy. So again,
wow.
I flew out there and talked to him. And we had a great interview. He's a really, really funny guy. And then after that, he liked Diane. Diane White is my wife, and she was a long-time, very successful Globe columnist. And he'd invite Diane and I, and we'd have dinner at his house. And he invited everybody from, you know, Sheldon Leonard. And Sheldon at that time had turned into one of the most successful TV producers ever with I Spy.
Yeah, for people that don't know him, what were some of the programs that he did? I know he did a lot. He did stuff with Desi Lu.
Yeah, well, you know, he did Make Room for Daddy. He did the Andy Griffith Show, I think, for a while. And he did I Spy. And he made a fortune producing these things. And it was really funny because those of us remember Sheldon Leonard as a character actor, you remember one kind of persona, but he's a brilliant businessman and he really knew show business and he knew how to put things together.
And for people that don't piece it together, Sheldon he had a career that spanned from radio all the way through like TV production. And in radio, he was really famous for like the Jack Benny Show and several other shows of kind of being the thug on the street. He'd be the guy that somebody would walk up on. In fact, one of the most famous lines in radio was the Jack Benny bit where he does the, you know, your money or your life. And that was Sheldon Leonard, for anybody who didn't know who he was.
Yeah, he was tipster at the racetrack.
Tipster at the racetrack, hey buddy, thug at the elevator.
What's that, Mark?
The guy at the elevator. One of my favorite ones was his Otis elevator bit with Jack Benny of which elevator to take, tying it into the racetrack. He's telling him, no, 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 you want Otis, number two. Don't take number one, you go with two.
Yeah, he was a brilliant guy. And, you know, and as I say, Julie and I have these dinners, and I remember Gloria Stewart, who was a phenomenal actress in the 30s, gorgeous, and she was, I think when she was coming to the dinners, I think she was in her mid-80s, and she was auditioning for Titanic, and she ended up playing the role that introduces the film where she's looking back on what happened at the Titanic, and she was the Kate Winslet when Kate Winslet was old character, and she had fabulous stories, and Max Schulman, who had Many Loves of Dobie Gillis, you know, he'd come, and we'd just sit around and talk, and they were really, really good. And then the other thing is, before I retired from the Globe and made a list of the people I wanted to interview, one of the people was Jimmy Stewart. And I made arrangements to go to see him at the studio. He had a little office in the studio, and we spent a whole afternoon walking around, like 4 hours, walking around to the studio and talking and telling stories. And at the end of it, we ended up in his office. And he didn't have any movie pictures in there. He had all pictures of airplanes because, of course, he was a pilot during the war and a colonel. But he loved airplanes. And he had a huge desk. And he was pretty tired at the end of the walking around and everything. And we sat down that, and I noticed that there's a whole stack of red envelopes in the corner of his desk. And I said, I know we're done here, Mr. But I have one more question. I said, what are those red envelopes for down there? And he goes, oh, those are thank you notes. I said, well, if you don't mind my asking, thank you notes for what? He goes, well, those are thank you notes for people that send me birthday cards. I said, wait a minute.
Oh, wow.
You mean you send a thank you note? I've gotten a few birthday cards in my life. I never sent a thank you note. And you're Jimmy Stewart, famous movie star, and he said, well, I'll tell you what, when I first came here in the thirds, you know, in the 30s, we were told certain things. And one of the things I was told by the head of publicity, Mr. Strickling, that is that these people that go to see your movies are not customers. We're not trying to sell them anything. They're your friends, and you should treat them that way. And that's what I do. So now, about 6 months later, it's his birthday. So I decide I'm going to send him a book about airplanes. So I sent him this really nice coffee table book with pictures of all these airplanes. And about 3 weeks later, I get a thank you note from him in a red envelope. And it said, Dear Michael, thank you very much for the book. I really like it a lot. Enjoy looking at it for a long time, and I appreciate the thoughtfulness. But what I really want to know, if you were just testing me to see if you get this thank you note. But
yeah,
that was an important
moment,
because when I started Old Friends, I always, no matter if somebody contributed a door, I sent them a handwritten thank you note. And I learned that from Mr. Stewart. He was a really, really tremendous guy. Obviously, a great star and a great actor, but, you know, fundamentally, a very, very nice human being.
You know, they claim that Lucille Ball, Lucy Arnaz, her daughter, claims that her mother always responded to anybody that wrote her personally. Said it might take her.
Yeah, I think it's after. I got a good Lucy story. You want to hear my good Lucy story?
Yeah, I'd love to hear a Lucy story.
All right. So it doesn't involve Lucy. It just involves Lucy's house. So now this is terrible name dropping, but that's what your whole show's about, right?
Sure.
Okay. So I'm at Jack Nicholson's house on Mulholland Drive. We get in the car. Dan Cahill's the driver. Jack was very smart because 99% of the time, if he wasn't going to play golf, he had a driver. So he couldn't get in trouble if he drank too much or smoked too much dope or anything. So he didn't want to get in trouble. So he had a driver named Dan Cahill. And Dan Cahill only drove two people, him and Bob Hope. Those were his two clients. So we're going downhill, going down towards the forum, go to the basketball game. And Jack's smoking a joint, and I'm drinking a beer in the back of this car, this nice car. And all of a sudden, there's a siren going off. And the cop pulls Dan over. And, of course, the windows are all shaded. He can't see us inside. But we can hear Dan say, Dan, the policeman says to Dan, "Who you got in there?" And Dan says, "Nobody." And he says, "Well, I smell something a little funny." And Dan says, "Well, you know, that's funny you should mention that, because I thought I smelled so funny when that truck just went by." And he said, "Okay." He says, "Wind down the window." He winds down the window, and there's Jack. Jack sticks his head out. He goes, "Evening, officer." He says, "Evening, Jack. How you doing? Good. Where are you going?" He says, "Oh, well, we're just with my friend. We're going down to the basketball game." You know, and he says, "Okay." He says, "Well, have a good time," the policeman says. And Jack says, "What's your hurry?" He says, "Well, I got to go catch up to that truck." And then, on the way back from the basketball game, we're driving back up the same way through Bel Air and everything. And Jack says, "Hey, Dan, I got to go to the bathroom tonight. I got to go out. I got to go to the bathroom." Jack, it's Bel Air. You just can't, you know, go. He goes, "Oh, see those pine trees over there? Yeah, stop over. Just stop. I'll get out. I'll be right back." He says, "Jack, that's Lucille Ball's house." And Jack goes, "Well, okay, she won't mind." So he goes over there, and, you know, he disappears into the darkness. And that's when Dan tells me his other client's Bob Hope, and we're talking back and forth about his job. And all of a sudden, we hear Jack say, "Here's Lucy," coming out of the darkness. And those are some of the encounters I had with Mr. Nicholson. His remains a good friend. I asked him once. I said, "How come we're friends?" I said, "We don't see each other. We hardly ever talk. You know, Shane, he'll send me a book once in a while, and I'll send him something, and all that." I said, "Why are we friends?" And he gave me another piece of really good advice. He says, "You know, you're the only friend I've ever had that never acted as a go-between." And I said, "Wow."
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I never thought of that, but there you go.
In a town where everybody's a go-between.
Well, yeah, same thing with the racing. And then I learned so much covering the movies, because the movie business is same as the horse business.
The movie business is a lot like the horse business.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as you and I have talked before, I worked out in the studios, not on your level. I mean, I was on the back end with suppliers, set builders, that type of thing. But I still got a taste of it. And it's very much like the horse industry. But if you take the attitude that you're kind of the guest in the house, they treat you pretty well. And that's been my experience in both industries. They kind of are okay. Most people are. You know, I had a piece of Desi Lou. You'll know this, but I bet most of our listeners wouldn't. And I had heard this, but I forgot about it. I was looking at stuff for today, and I came across this. So, you know, Desi Lou goes along, and they're very successful. And then, you know, later on, and I never speak ill of anything, but gets to a point where Lucy has to buy Desi out. So she buys out Desi. And now it's just Lucy and the board of directors. And Desi, for people who don't know, he was really the head of Desi Lou. He was the guy, he was much more of a front than people realized. He really had a head for it. She had two shows that really set her apart that her board of directors panned, said, "Don't waste your time. It's not going to go. It's going to be a fortune, and we don't think they're going to amount to anything." Mission Impossible and Star Trek. Mission Impossible went on to run 7 seasons, get 6 Emmys, and Star Trek is, you know, the greatest TV show of all time. And it's just kind of amazing that she trusted her gut and went against her own board and everybody, and greenlit those two shows. And those turned out to be probably the two most successful shows besides I Love Lucy that Desi Lou ever put out.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. But, you know, so many things happen that way where that surprised you. There was a director named Richard Brooks who was a really good director. He made Elmer Gantry. He made In Cold Blood. He did Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. He did The Professionals. And he's a really, really good director. But by the time his career was winding down, he made a movie called Fever Pitch with Ryan O'Neal. And it's about sports gambling. And Ryan O'Neal is a professor or a teacher or something. And he's got a, you know, well, anyway, I hardly remember anything except how bad the movie was. So I started off my review by asking the question that seems rhetorical, but it's not, which is, you know, how could the man who made Elmer Gantry and The Blackboard Jungle and Something of Value and all these great movies In Cold Blood, how could the same person have directed this movie because it's so terrible? And I went on to describe, you know, how banal it was, and it lacked everything else, everything that old Richard Brooks. So I, at the end of it, I said, it couldn't have been Richard Brooks. It must be another guy. So that came out on Saturday, and on Monday, I met my desk, and the phone rings, and I answer the phone, and the guy starts yelling and screaming every curse word in the world at me, screaming, and, you know, making all kinds of references to my last name, which was not very nice. But anyway, but when he cooled off, I said, you know, Mr. Brooks, I'll tell you something. I said, I really admire your work. I admire your work as a director. I just think that, you know, when you have time to settle in a little bit and you look at this movie, it's not going to be at the pantheon of your accomplishments. So it was a long pause, and I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. This is on Monday. If you'll let me come out there and interview you, then I'll put down what you say about the movie, and you can have your say. Because you don't have the guts to do that. I said, it doesn't take guts. It's just a good story, I think. Because you're absolutely wrong. And you can say whatever you want. So he says, you... So I screamed. I said, no, when can I come? He says, come out. All right, Wednesday at lunchtime. I'll see if you can come here for lunch. And he had an office at MGM. I said, okay, fine. So the time Globe had money, off I go. I go down and make a few other arrangements on doing other things besides talking to him. So I go to his office, and I open up, I knock on the door, and I hear this gruff voice say, oh, is that? And I said, this is Michael Blum from Boston. All right, come on in. And I open up the door, and he starts throwing stuff at me. He's throwing scripts and all kinds of stuff. And I find out midway through our interview that actually those weren't scripts. They were affidavits from actual, you know, addicted gambling
lawsuit,
and he's telling me all this movie's true and this and that and the other thing. And I said, Richard, you know as well as I do that, you know, it doesn't make any difference if it's true or not. If there's a lot of things true that don't really make very good movies. And I said, The Professionals isn't true, but it's a great movie. I said, Elmer Gantry is just based on a crazed teacher, and that's not really true in the technical sense. I said, even In Cold Blood, that was based on a true story, isn't true in the truest sense of the word. And I said, but I don't want to argue with you because I really like you, and I meant it. I really respect your work. I mean, we started talking about Elmer Gantry. We started talking about some of the other movies. Well, to make this already too long story a little longer, we became really good friends. And again, just like Julie, every time Diane and I went to California, we'd go out to eat with Richard, and we'd always go out to dinner. He'd always bring somebody else. And like the first time he brought Robert Culp, and he and Robert Culp had this great idea. And now it seems like, why didn't they do it? They couldn't get it by anybody, but it was a true crime show. Now they all they have are true crime shows, but this, they had the first one all lined up how they wanted to do it. And then next time he brought Mort Saul, who is married to Miss March, I think, of 1958. And that was fun. I mean, and we got to be really, really good friends. Found out later on that he used to play poker games with Angie Dickinson, Mrs. Ira Gershwin, and Barbara Sinatra, Frank Sinatra's widow. That was their poker game. Anyway, it's a really great thing, and it's a great history. And again, those are the days we could actually sit down with somebody and have a conversation and develop a relationship over the years. I'm still in contact with Nicholson. Julie, unfortunately passed away, and Richard passed away, but Angie's still alive, and it's fun, you know. Once the curtain drops and everything, and you get to know some of these people a little bit better than you would have if they're just trying to sell you a movie.
You know, the funny thing is, as you know this, I mean, Casablanca is my favorite movie of all time. I mean, way before I met you, I mean, it was like, it's always been a favorite. And I think it's just because, to me, it's like, it's kind of funny because I know it's not, I know it's not probably the most well-written movie, but it just, there's something about it that just hooks
you. It
could be
the best written movie. I mean, when you think of all the lines that came out of that, and the lines were all organic. They weren't like pasted on, you know. Like round up.
No, what was the story? Because there's a story behind it. Because Julie he wrote several movies, and this was not one of his, like, ones that he was the most proud of. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, that's what he used to say. But over the years, he finally reluctantly admitted that, yeah. I think the reason is because there was a conflict about who did what between Julie and his brother felt and Howard Koch, and they, before Julie died, they resolved all this stuff. I think one of the reasons Julie would denigrate the picture a little bit is because he didn't want to give credit to Howard, because he thought Howard took too much credit. I'm sure Howard thought he took too much credit, and nobody cared about any credit back then. I mean, Julie's brother, when they were working on The Big Sleep, Howard Hawks came over to their office and said, "Look, I need something here. And you got to come over and help me." And so Philip went over, and he wrote one of the greatest scenes in the whole movie in 15 minutes. And a great dialogue between Bogey and Bacall. And that's the way the place was. So everybody helped everybody else. And nobody was into, like, who did what when. And nobody took notes about all that kind of stuff. You showed up. This was my job. If Jack Warner, who nobody liked, if he told us to do something, then we did it, and we got paid very well, and it was very amusing. I had a lot of time. In fact, Julie ended up dating for quite a while, Judy Holliday, back in the early 50s.
Oh, wow.
And he was a boxing champion. He graduated from Penn State. He was an intercollegiate boxing champion in the NCAA. He didn't win the national championship, but I think he went through the division and beat all of his rivals in the Penn State arena.
Of the stories that I had heard is that he was really proud of Mr. Skeppington, which was a movie that most people probably never heard of. Is that true, that he really liked that one and it just didn't go anywhere?
Yes, but I'll tell you one thing. Betty Davis was never invited to any of the dinners.
Oh, no.
He said it was terrible. He said he and his brother, as a reward for writing Casablanca, they made the brothers producers on Mr. Skeffington. So they became producers for one movie, the only movie they ever produced. And he said it was a terrible experience. It was like you were tearing your hair out because Betty Davis would like certain things one day and not like them the next day. And she complained about the costumes and complained about this, and she liked to change words, and she wanted to ad lib some stuff. And it was like every day they went to the studio, they couldn't wait to just get back to the studio and write, stay away from the sets and the movies and the productions, because they did like the writing. But that wasn't a particularly positive experience for either Julie or his brother.
That's hilarious.
But
we touched on a name that I got to go back to.
The adapted Arsenic and Old Lace, and they made Yankee Doodle Dandy. I mean, they made so many really, really good movies together. And what's it like? He's his twin brother, and they work together. And
yeah,
they came up with the whole line from Casablanca about round up the usual suspects simultaneously driving to work one day when they couldn't figure out how they were going to resolve it. How's the ending of that movie? And then they come up with the line, Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship, and off they go. I mean, this movie is just filled with great insight and great lines, and the studio
They claim that some of the top movie lines of all time come out of Casablanca.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
I remember. If I remember right, there's like three in the top ten.
Wow.
And some of the company in that is like Gone with the Wind, and you know, several of the real, you know, just blockbusters.
Well, you know, the movie was actually, the interesting thing was the movie was buried for a long time and nobody paid much attention to it. But during finals at Harvard University, one of their traditions was they had midnight showings at the theater in Harvard Square of Casablanca. And the popularity that it engendered among the students, you couldn't get a ticket at that show anymore because it was a big celebration. And there was even a cafe next door called Casablanca that they named after the movie, so people could go in there, sit in rattan chairs and pretend they were, you know, they were listening to Bogey and Bacall.
Cool.
Yeah.
No, I mean, but it is kind of funny down through the years, you know, as you know, I mean, I love comedy. And, you know, I think back to a lot of the you know, real big comedies that we think of today, they didn't really start out that way. You know, I mean, even like some of the more recent ones like Tommy Boy, Coneheads, they had kind of soft start and then they kind of become evergreens. But in the beginning, they weren't blockbusters.
Each movie has its own organic life, for better or for worse. Some die early, some die late.
Some never die.
Very few of them live on like Casablanca, figuring out that it's ever done.
Yeah, no, it's true. But it's a movie that kind of holds your attention. You know, it's kind of timeless in a weird way.
Oh, it's totally timeless.
And yeah, I think it's timeless because it touches on a lot of the stuff that even goes on in the world today.
Yep. Yeah. It's universal.
It is. So you touched on another name that we both know well, Angie Dickinson. So you and Angie have been friends for a long time.
Yeah, really.
And I actually have a funny story with this one. You'll remember this. So as you know, as our listeners may know, I have two kids, Keith and Grace. Grace is my daughter. She's now a freshman in college. But Grace has been tagging along with me. Keith and Grace both have since they were little. One time, way back, Michael, Diane, I'm not sure who else was there, probably Nancy, and Grace was pretty small, and she is sitting at the table with us having dinner, and Michael's telling a story about Angie Dickinson, the story about you and Diane going to the show and using her seats, and Frank coming out and missing his mark, and I'll let you tell the story. But the funny thing was, Grace sits there, doesn't say a word. And when it gets all done, she goes home, starts school. The teacher asked the kids, you know, did you guys do anything exciting this summer? Anything unique? Grace stands up without missing a beat and says, my dad's friend Michael made Frank Sinatra miss his mark.
That's pretty funny.
That was hilarious.
She's right.
Especially for a kid that I don't think any of us even thought was listening to what we were talking about. So I'll let you tell a story. There was a story where you had went to interview Frank.
No.
No.
What happened was this. Frank was doing one of his last tours. It might have been the last one. I'm not sure. But and he wasn't doing any interviews. So my editor said to me, Shivas Regal is paying Angie Dickinson to go around to talk about Frank. Do you want to go have a drink with her and talk about Frank? oh, yeah, are you kidding? This will be great. So I meet in the hotel bar, and we walk into the bar, and the piano player starts playing songs from her ex-husband, Bert Bacharach.
Oh, brother.
And we're driving, and you're doing in there, and he's doing a medley of Bert songs. Everybody in the bar recognizes her and applauds. And we sit down, and we start talking. And we really hit it up because we knew someone. She knew Richard Brooks. She goes talked about the poker game. We knew a lot of the same people because Hollywood's such a small town. You know a lot of people.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
We start chatting, and you know it's going really well. And we're talking about Rio Bravo and working with John Rain and Ricky Nelson and Walter Brennan, Dean Martin, and everybody, and that, and what it was like hanging around with Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. and all the Rat Pack guys, Joey Bishop, and all of them, and we're having a really nice conversation. And at the end of it, she says, I'm a little tired. She goes, have you ever seen Frank? I said, no, we've never seen him. So she says, why don't you take my tickets? Just take my tickets. The only thing I ask is that when you're done, when the show's over, you come back here and you can have a drink and I can meet your wife. I said, okay, that'll be good. So I called Diane. We go there. And naturally, the seats in the 1 and 1A, there's the red carpet. Here we are. And all that. So we're sitting there, and Frank starts off a little slow. He's not like really, he's not right. He's missing a few things here and there, but by the third song, he starts really going, and it's all, he's as good as he's ever been. I mean, he's really sensational. And about the fifth or sixth song, he's going to sing The Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square. Great song. And he looks down as if he's going to sing it to Angie. And he looks and he sees Diana be there. He looks in the chair and he starts to get this very quizzical expression on his face. He doesn't know what's going on. And he went through with the song. But the expression on his face when he was expecting to see Angie Dickinson and saw us was priceless. And then later we went back to the hotel, talked to Angie again, and we began, we sent each other stuff in the mail and we talked all the time. And we'd see her, went to California. Then we started All Friends. One of the things I did, I called her about a horse I really wanted to get. It wasn't in a bad situation, but it was in a really good situation, a retired stallion. And she said, how much you need? I said, $5,000. So she says, okay, fine. So I told her the name of the horse was perfect for her. And she says, what is it? I go, Academy Award. And so she laughed. And so we get Academy Award here. And then the blood horse calls her up because they want to do a story on her. Her participation in getting Academy Awards to retired old friends, and she said, "Well, you know, Michael asked me to do this, and I'm glad to. I like the idea of taking really good care of these horses." She was really good, and at the end of it, she said, "Besides, I've always wanted to have an Academy Award, and now I've got one." Anyway, she's just really, really great. And then she came here and stayed with us for a few days a while back, and the third day she was here, I brought my little miniature horse, little Silver Charmers, passed away recently, but he was a great little horse, and he used to come in the house all the time. So early in the morning before breakfast, I brought him in the house, and I left. And Angie comes down, and my phone rings, and I go, hello? She goes, Michael, it's Angie. Yes. There's a horse in your living room. I said, I know. He comes in, he watches Al Roker do the weather, and then he goes back out, and so... That's
so has Little Brown graduated to where he goes in the house yet?
Shortly thereafter. What's that?
Has Little Brown graduated to where he goes in the house yet?
Oh, yeah. It took him about 15 minutes to figure out the whole place. He's in the house everywhere. He yells at me when I'm not doing things correctly. You know, he's figured it all out. So he's our other miniature horse. If people want to meet him, I'd be glad to show him around to old friends anytime they'd like to come.
And for those that don't know, Little Brown is in...
I'll tell more stories until... I'll tell you that. I went and gave this talk one time at a place in Lexington. And they advertised it on TV, and it was a big deal. And so I go to the thing, and I'm there, and I'm thinking, I can't be in the right place because there's not that many people. So I finally said to the guy who was doing the landscaping, I said, is this where this event's going? Yeah, that's it. And I walk in there, there's like 9 people, and they expected like 150. So anyway, Diane came, thank goodness. So I start telling the stories about the horses and things, and I said to the, I said, look, there's only 9 of us here. So if you have any questions, just, you know, just let me know, and we'll do whatever you want. So about 20 minutes into it, Diane raises her hand. I said, yes, the woman in the back, please. And she goes, you already told them that story. I said, okay, I guess we better wrap it up.
Diane is great. Well, we'd be remiss without mentioning this. So who Michael's talking about is his wife. Diane White is what she went by when she was writing. And she was a syndicated columnist for the Boston Globe. I would encourage anybody to look up her articles. You can find them, her columns. They're still out there. And, you know, I've said this a million times. I really hope someday she puts her columns in a book, or somebody does. Because I think her columns are very interesting. And I think, you know, it's one of those that a lot of it is kind of timeless. It's interesting no matter when you read it.
Yeah,
she's written
she's
books.
Amazing.
She's a brilliant writer. It is kind of amazing to have two brilliant writers in the same house. But, I mean, you guys are both really acclaimed writers and do very, very well. And
my favorite story about that, Mark, is that, of course, her name's Diane White. Now, one year I came back from Saratoga. We'd been going to Saratoga and on a little vacation and going to the race and everything. And it was the first time I did so well gambling that I got to pay for the whole vacation with my gambling winnings. And I actually came back with cash in my pocket, which is a very unusual occurrence. But anyway, so we come back. And I knew that year I was going to be named Best Film Critic by Boston Magazine in their Best of Boston issue, because all the other movie critics got big, big jobs. You know, David Denby went to the New Yorker with Stephen Schiff. Janet Muslin went to the New York Times. David Anson went to Newsweek. Heck, they had to name me Best Movie Critic. I was the only one left. So we come back, and I go to the newsstand, and every year they would name Diane Best Columnist. So I go to the newsstand to get it, and I go to the media section, the Best of Boston issue, and I'm looking there. There's Best Lobster over here, Best, you know, Restaurant over here, Best this, and I go, oh, here's me. And Diane, they have a drawing, Snow White, and she's Snow White. And it says, all the other columnists are dwarfs, especially her husband, Dopey.
You can always tell on your friends.
Yeah. So that was in the house now, as I'm sitting here at the table, I'm looking right over. Dopey's right down there behind that other thing. But we have stuffed Dopeys, pictures of Dopey. We got a lot of Dopeys around here.
I got to take a brief minute, and we're going to jump back into it here and thank Tony Steak and Seafood. Tony has been kind enough to bring this show to you people today. Tony's Kitchen started in a small town in Italy. Just like many other Italian families, spent a lot of time in the kitchen. His mom has a saying, there's always room for one more at her table. Tony's adopted that at all 4 of his restaurants, Tony's Steak and Seafood, of Lexington, Bowling Green, Cincinnati, and Indianapolis, Indiana. If you're looking for an experience more than just a meal, Tony's Steak and Seafood. You'll thank us that we pointed you there. And Michael and I have both been there, and we can tell you firsthand, it's amazing. They do a great job, great people, and they make you feel like you're part of the family. So we can't thank them enough. You know, another one I was going to ask you about, because we've talked a little bit, you know, we keep going back to, like, Julie. There was a really good story you told me one time about Walter Matthau with Julie.
Well, yeah. Julie wrote, I don't know if you've seen that movie, Pete and Tilly, but Julie wrote that movie for Walter and Carol Burnett.
Oh, wow.
And I was halfway through. Julie wanted me to write his biography, so I was halfway through that. And he'd come to Boston, and we were talking and doing some interviewing and stuff. And on the way back, flying back, that plane had to have an emergency landing in Cleveland because Julie had a stroke. and it was really bad. And about a week and a half later, he was at a very fancy hospital in Beverly Hills. And I flew out there to see him. And I went in, and it was lunchtime. And I hadn't seen him after he had this terrible stroke. And he was in the dining area, and they're putting on a Purim play. So he had a guitarist and a singer putting on this little play, and they were feeding Julie. So Julie's eating this gruely stuff, and it's terrible, and it's like, it was awful. He didn't say a word, and there was stuff in the screamer weed or whatever it was in his mouth, and it's drooling, and they were mopping it up, and I'm thinking, how can this guy end his life this way? Because his whole life was so filled with so much humor and so much fun and so much gaiety, and here we are. We're in Beverly Hills in this fancy hospital and everything. But it was just so humiliating, and I can't imagine how tough it was for Julie, because it was tough for me just to be there. And they kept playing the song. It was pretty bad Purim play, whatever it was. It wasn't good, and so. After about an hour, here comes Walter Matthau. And I didn't know Walter at the time. It's the first time I ever saw him. He walks in. He goes, Julie, come on, let's go. The football game's on. Walter always bet football games. He said, look, it's Syracuse and Penn State. Come on, Julie, you've got to go watch the game. Julie still hasn't said anything. They wrap Julie up. The Purim play's over, and they put him in the wheelchair and bring him back in there, put him into bed. Walter puts the TV on with the football game that's hanging off the ceiling, this little TV. And Julie opens his eyes, and the only words he uttered to me, and the last words he ever uttered to me were, that's the worst play I've ever seen. And then he went back to sleep. I mean talk about a great exit line. And then he died just a week later. So,
Wow! So he didn't last long after he had his stroke.
No,
a few weeks.
It was very hard on him and his wife Ann, and you know, son, his brother Philip died young. His brother Philip died in the early 50s, and Julie lasted forever. And I think that was tough on him, because I think that was the most important relationship in his life. His wife Ann was fabulous, and the other interesting thing for your listeners is his nephew was Leslie Epstein, who was a terrific novelist, wrote a great book called The King of the Jews, along with several others, and he's written several autobiographical books that talk about growing up in Beverly Hills. He took Jane Fonda to the prom. He might be a good guest for you. So,
yeah, I'd love to have him on.
Leslie taught creative writing at Boston University and in the master's program. And he had a nice family. Eileen ran a really nice women's store in Brookline, Massachusetts. And he had three children. Anya, who ended up being the head writer and producer of the TV show Homicide: Life on the Street. Then he had twins. Paul was the head of suicide prevention among teenagers in Brookline. And the third one was Theo Epstein, who ended up being the general manager of the Red Sox, got in the World Series. Then he became the general manager of the Chicago Cubs and got them the World Series. He's still working in baseball. So that's the family.
Wow.
Amazing. Just an amazing family. Yeah. So
that is amazing.
Again, it's just because you make a phone call and you find out that it's the same guy that wrote, you know, that wrote Casablanca, wrote this Tom Conti movie, and I'm trying to remember what the name of it was. It's a Peter DeVries novel. I wish Diane was here. She'd remember that. But anyway, it's the same with the horses. I mean, the horses are the celebrities. People come here to hear the stories of these horses and their great accomplishments. And again, if we're here in Georgetown, Kentucky, and if anybody would like to come and see them, they can look up our website, Old Friends Thoroughbred Retirement, and find out what we do here, which is, you know, make sure that these horses, when they retire, have a gentle landing. and treat them with the respect that they've earned. So,
and we promote old friends every week. So for anybody who's listening, you know, what Michael's talking about is the farm that he founded, Old Friends Farm. It's oldfriendsequine.org. They are the probably, in my opinion, the most prominent thoroughbred retirement in the world. But beauty of it is they are one of the few places that you can be face-to-face with a Kentucky Derby winner, with, you know, a Breeders' Cup winner, and Michael's there almost every day that he can take you around. We are up against our hour, so we're going to have to call it a day, Michael. But we have to do this again. And you know what we should do? We should con Diane to coming on with us. Diane's got a really amazing career, and I'd love to hear a little bit more about her stories.
Yeah, she's terrific. We're still married after all these years.
I know. Like you say, check the bus before it leaves. But
yeah,
Michael,
exactly.
I can't thank you enough for coming on today. I always enjoy talking to you. An hour feels like 5 minutes. It's never enough time. We want to thank Tony's Steak and Seafood, Lexington, Cincinnati, Indianapolis, and Bowling Green. Oldfriendsequine.org. If you're in Kentucky or anywhere close, it's definitely worth the trip. One of the top tourist destinations in Kentucky. We support No Fallen Heroes and mbgrayhealthcare.com. We'll talk to you again next week. This has been Hollywood and Horsepower, and thank you for taking the time to join us today. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Mark. Yeah, we're only 14 minutes from Tony's.
It's amazing. We've got to go. Thanks, Don.
Thank you so much.
So stay a while. You're in the driver's seat where the road and the rhythm finally meet.
Stick around. Never know who's next, and trust me, they got a story worth hearing.